From Washington, the American Broadcasting Company brings you From the Capitol, a weekly interview program based on a major news story here in the nation's capital. The stakes are going up in Vietnam. There's a possibility of a bigger war and of direct conflict between the United States and Red China. Our guest is Dr. Bernard B. Fall, professor of international relations at Howard University in Washington, D.C., who's been to Vietnam repeatedly since 1953. He has visited North Vietnam, where he interviewed Ho Chi Minh and other top communist leaders in 1962, and has just returned from the battlefields of South Vietnam. Dr. Fall will be interviewed in his library by ABC Pentagon correspondent Bill Downs, and here with the first question, ABC State Department correspondent John Scali.
Dr. Fall, the United States seems on the verge of escalating the war further in Vietnam. Do you expect that the introduction of more American fighting troops can substantially change the battle outlook?
Mr. Scali, the war as of last spring has become unlosable. The new American troops, I'm afraid, will simply and purely have to stay in to maintain the equilibrium with the new North Vietnamese forces that are coming in. I don't think that the equilibrium, specific weights of the two sides have been changed.
Well, if it's unlosable on our side, is it also unwinnable by your terms?
I would say that for the time being, there is no real win in the offing.
What is your prediction? What's going to happen?
I go along with the official view on that particular score, which says it's going to be a 10-year operation. It's going to be a long, bloody stalemate.
And what will we have when it finishes up?
Hopefully, we'll have proven to the Viet Cong or perhaps to other National Liberation War advocates that they can't win. This is, in my view, the most optimistic estimate. More likely, we'll simply have stalemated the situation, and we'll still not have a stable South Vietnam. We still won't have a viable South Vietnam.
Dr. Fall, despite the fact that many people say this is going to be a long war that may go 10 or 20 years, it's really difficult to believe that it can drag on that long without some irresistible pressure for more dramatic military action. In this day and age, is a 10 or 20 year low scale but bloody war possible?
Mr. Scali, let's look at the record. The French fought in Vietnam the first time for 8 years. The British fought in Malaya for 13 years. The emergency in Malaya lasted from June the 18th, 1948, until July 31, 1960. And the French again fought in Algeria for 8 years. 8 years and 8 months, in fact. So you see, it can definitely be done. It's unfortunate. But people do live with that kind of revolutionary warfare situation for a decade and more.
Yes, but you're talking not about the military power of Britain or France. You're talking about the military power of the United States now.
Now, what we're in fact talking about is the mood of the United States, because military power isn't simply the answer in this particular thing. Is the United States willing to spend 10 years in a low-level war or not? I don't think the United States is. I think the United States is going to attempt to escalate the war and seek a military solution on a shorter range in 10 years.
Well, then this argues for some sort of conclusion or watershed within a matter of a few months, or indeed at most a few years.
Well, that's precisely it. Some people think that the watershed may well be decided as we are talking at this moment. In the new decisions that are being made by the president and his advisors, that there will be a very serious escalation. But I'm very much afraid, and I think I've been outspoken on this for maybe perhaps as long as 8 to 10 months, of a change of heart or mind in the Soviet Union. I'm very much afraid that the present situation... In the Soviet Union.
You mean that the Soviet Union will make a rapprochement with Beijing, the two of them did together to...
Not as much perhaps a rapprochement with Peking, but simply and purely an agonizing reappraisal and saying, well, whether we like it or not, our own credibility is at stake. It just as much as the United States says, we may not approve of the kind of non-democratic government Saigon has, but our overriding interest is in preserving South Vietnam from collapse. The North Vietnamese may well, the Russians may well say, well, we don't approve of the way Peking and Hanoi read their marks. But the overriding demands on our side are that we come to North Vietnam's help.
Well, have we not in the past... months of fighting, been very careful to say we do not want to change the government, that we are not seeking the defeat of the Ho government, that we are seeking to negotiate with them for an end of the fighting. In other words, we are trying to keep the whole government separate, not only from Beijing, but also from Moscow.
Yeah, well, this is very nice. We may perhaps achieve this, or rather, we may think that we're achieving it by the way we are operating. But the way we think our own acts react on Moscow may be entirely different. In other words, the way Moscow feels what we're doing may entirely change.
Will you say that we are fighting to kill the cause of wars of liberation?
That's right.
Now, what are the Vietnamese fighting for, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong?
Well, the North Vietnamese fight for a limited objective, which is simply and purely as they say, obtain a neutralized South Vietnamese state, and B, later on, reunification of the two Vietnams. The Chinese are obviously not supporting the North Vietnamese simply and purely to achieve a limited North Vietnamese aim. The Chinese are out to prove that national liberation war is a viable tactic of operations in a nuclear stalemate era.
Do you think that the Chinese would intervene directly to maintain this proof?
I would say that the Chinese probably haven't got what it takes. This is perhaps on what Washington bases its own estimates, saying that the Chinese are so far talking a great deal, but they haven't got what it takes to stand up, not what is in liberation war, but what has become a conventional Korean-type war. Let's not kid ourselves. What's being fought today in Vietnam is not a guerrilla operation. It's not a counterinsurgency operation. It's a Korean-type war.
What you're saying that the Chinese military machine is so outdated because it hasn't had modern supplies from the Russians for quite a while, to the point where Chinese leaders have to be cautious?
Exactly. Chinese leaders have every reason to be cautious, A, because their military machine is obsolete, and B, because they have targets that can be hit, meaning their cherished atomic bomb plants in Lan Chau. That is perhaps why North Vietnam, in fact, is trying to drag the Russians into it. A, the Russians are much more invulnerable to American pressure than the Chinese are, which is one thing, and B, the Russians have what it takes to help them, meaning MiG-21 jet fighters and sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles, neither of which the Chinese can provide them.
Well, if
there is one moment on this subject, there is a school of thought in this country led by retired generals that say one of their fears is that the Chinese will not come into it.
Well, that's it. This is the aero geopoliticians, Admirals Mahan of the Air Force, if you want to. Who think that the best way, really, the only enemy that's worth taking on in the Far East is not North Vietnam and not the Viet Cong, but basically Red China. And that if Red China were to be bombed back into the Stone Age now, it would save us a great deal of trouble 20 or 30 years hence. That theory, I'm afraid, is not quite in the cards at the moment. I would say that probably it is the estimate of the United States that to take on Red China may create political complications which cannot be readily controlled. And in our own case, let's look at Vietnam again, because we lose track of Vietnam. So many people are now mesmerized with Hanoi that people forget there are still 230,000 guerrillas in South Vietnam, of whom only 35,000 are North Vietnamese infiltrees. So the Chinese issue is surely an issue that can be looked at. In other words, let's bomb Peking or let's bomb Lan Chau. But the fact still is that we're still stuck with the guerrillas in South Vietnam. We're still stuck with the North Vietnamese army. That's a 450,000-man army.
You say that this war out there is not a Munich, but it is a Spain. Could you explain that?
Yes. The Munich aspect is simply an aspect of tests of will. For example, it is a very oversimplified view of Munich, but the view is that in 1938 had the British and French stood up to the Nazis, the Germans would have not gone into Czechoslovakia. Had they not gone into Czechoslovakia, obviously they would not have taken on Poland. We may not have had World War II. I assure you, having been at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials for 3 years, a war crimes research analyst, this is an oversimplified view of history. The Germans may not have taken the Sudetenland in September 38. They may have taken all of Czechoslovakia in 39 anyhow. And, for example, in the case of Poland, we have documented evidence that the Germans said, we want a war. We don't want a negotiation. We want a war. And it's exactly what they got. In other words, nothing would have been avoided in all likelihood. Now, this is very often being said about Vietnam. If we don't stand up in South Vietnam, the North Vietnamese, the communists may be encouraged to take on the next country.
Well, that's the official United States government position.
That's the domino theory.
It's not necessarily the domino theory. It's just that appetite feeds on itself.
Appetite always feeds on itself, and vice versa also. We have cases where you win one war, and it doesn't stop anybody else from trying the next one. After all, the Germans themselves should have been discouraged. By that logic, Germany should have been discouraged by its defeat of 1918 from trying in 1939, but they weren't stopped.
But how does this compare to Spain, Dr. Fuller?
Well, then the difference in Spain was that Spain was more than simply a test of wills. It was a dress rehearsal. It was a dress rehearsal of World War II, a real dress rehearsal. So, you know, where its weapons were tested, techniques were tested, the dive bomber and 88-millimeter gun combination, the tanks, and so on and so forth. And I feel that Vietnam, therefore, is much closer to that. In other words, in Vietnam, what is being tested are techniques of counterinsurgency. There are weapon systems that are being tested, things such as the grenade launchers, the amphibious vehicles, new aircraft, and so on and so forth. And on the other side, too. The other side precisely is testing whether a guerrilla warfare force can stand up to a heavily armed, Air Force-supported modern force.
Well, do you think this is the Vietnam War, then, is a dress rehearsal for an inevitable World War III?
No, not the inevitable World War III, but other, in my view, inevitable clashes of similar kinds, perhaps in Venezuela, perhaps in Colombia. In other words, similar combinations of revolutionary warfare operators on one side and the United States with sophisticated weaponry on the other.
You say then this is a dress rehearsal of the new Chinese theory of the rural society overcoming the revolutionary rural society overcoming the so-called urban nations.
Urban nations. Exactly. I think, as I put it there.
Well, isn't it important then that we win this one? Because if we pull out and it is interpreted as a defeat, then will not your revolutionary rural societies in Latin America and other parts of the world, Africa, be encouraged to stage these?
This is exactly the point which I like to make and emphasize. The real victory that we should have to win is a victory of our reforms over their politics, because this is the real contest.
Well, how can you reform as long as people are being shot all around you who seek to put reforms into effect, such as the South Vietnamese village chiefs and the people from Saigon?
But unfortunately, Mr. Scali, what happened in Vietnam is precisely the other way around. What happened is that you had a failure of reform first, and the communists fed on that failure of reform to foist their guerrilla movements.
I accept that, but you have a situation now where a government perhaps belatedly recognizes that reform behind the lines in order to give people hope is an integral part of the entire military effort. Now, how can you carry out these reforms as long as the other side keeps shooting and murdering and terrorizing the people who are trying to carry out your reforms?
Well, this is precisely the lesson to be learned, and that is that you better start reforming as early as possible before you have to go into major warfare to protect the rice fields you're going to reform. And this is a hope, and this is precisely what the communists hope, that we will be stupid enough to continue to try to effect heavy-handed military cures because everything else has failed. This is because there has been too much time spent before reforms have been attempted. So you see, I come back to the fact what is being learned in Vietnam is perhaps that we may still win on the battlefield temporarily, but the real battle, which is one of the communist ability at setting up their own competitive administrative system in rural areas, their own quote-unquote reforms, because theirs are just as phony as some of ours have been, may still prevail in the long run. In other words, this is what they hope to test, field test, let's say, in Vietnam for elsewhere.
I'm a little confused as to how you see the future. If, as seems highly likely, we escalate this war, send a lot more troops and a lot more military equipment and apply it more effectively, and if the North Vietnamese government at some point seems on the verge of throwing in the sponge, do you think that the Chinese will insist that this war be continued to the point where they will send their own troops across the border to fight the Americans?
Frankly, Mr. Scali, I don't think that the Chinese intervention with ground troops is going to be the immediate Chinese response, simply because it'll buy an enormous amount of damage, as we already said before, on the Chinese themselves, like such as an American bombardment of the atomic bomb plants. And the North Vietnamese are not in dire need of troops. They have a 450,000-man army sitting in North Vietnam. They've used so far two, let's say perhaps three
divisions
inside South Vietnam, which means they still got something like about 18 or 19 divisions left in North Vietnam.
But the point, Dr. Fall, is that I believe that it's inevitable at some point that we're going to cause the North Vietnamese enough damage so that they're going to think seriously of going to the conference table. My question is, will the Chinese allow them? And if, in order to prevent this, will they offer volunteers or even their own forces?
Well, here again, we come to the real crunch line. If we were assured of Russian support, for example, if the Russians were to say to the North Vietnamese, look, fellows, we are not interested in getting into a major war with the United States. We're going to back you on that one. Stand up to the Chinese, and you can go to the conference table safely. That would be fine. Unfortunately, we don't have that kind of Russian guarantee for the North Vietnamese, not as far as I know. In fact, what we do have, and this came out recently in various pieces out of Peking and Moscow, the Russians have indeed attempted to help North Vietnam fight that war. After all, they're not fighting it with Chinese SAM missiles, but with Russians.
But
with
a very limited Soviet commitment, as far as we know, Dr.
Yes, but the commitment was limited, apparently, by Chinese restrictions rather than by Moscow's will. There was an article which I recently found in the British press by Edward Crankshaw, who has got excellent East European connections, which show that last spring the Russians attempted to acquire two transit air bases in China, as well as transit a 4,000-man force to North Vietnam of Russian troops. Obviously, 4,000 men aren't infantry, but probably missile specialists, communication specialists, and so on. In other words, there has been a Russian attempt at helping the North Vietnamese in a significant way.
Yes, but you take into account an answer to a question like mine, realizing what the struggle is between Moscow and Peking. In other words, if the Russians continue either to be unable to provide as much aid as they would like, or if they decide for reasons of their own that they don't want to provide additional assistance, and the war reaches the critical point for the North Vietnamese, what do you think the Chinese will do?
I would say then, in all likelihood, the Chinese would simply let the war die. This is precisely, again, where we come back to what I consider perhaps wishful thinking in Washington, is to think that, well, it's just like Greece, it's just like Azerbaijan, the Russians won't concede anything, the Chinese won't concede anything, they'll just, or like in Malaya or in the Philippines, they'll just let the guerrillas die. If this were true, it would be nice, but I don't quite think it's in the card. The Russians are, the Chinese and the Russians, for that matter, are too much committed to this thing.
What should we do about the sanctuary that the guerrillas have in Cambodia and in Laos, and the supply line along the Ho Chi Minh Trail?
The famous story of the sanctuary has been haunting counterinsurgents for years and years. Lay to rest the Cambodian sanctuary. I've been in Cambodia up and down. I was last summer there when there was charges levied about the 325th Division having its headquarters in Cambodia, and the Cambodians gave the British and the Australian military attachés and the French military attachés, these are the only friendly military attachés in Cambodia, aren't any communist attachés there, officially at least anyway. And we all went right up there where the 325th Division was supposed to be, and we found a perfectly roadless piece of track and nothing in sight that could be construed as a camp. Later on, the New York Times people were up there in the same area, too. There's beyond the slightest question, there are transits in the remotest northeastern corner of the country. If you look at the map, there's a sort of a little Cambodian finger sticking out into Laos, and there's, in all likelihood, they walk right through the jungle. Now, the Laotian side, so the Cambodian aspect isn't terribly important. The Laotian aspect, of course, is important. The Ho Chi Minh Trail goes right through eastern Laos. Now, there's only one thing about this. If you recall, 2 years ago, the Ho Chi Minh Trail was brought up and sort of all of a sudden died down when people discovered a lot of the stuff was coming in by boat, in fact, right along the Vietnamese coast, right under the noses of the 7th Fleet and the Vietnamese Navy. You remember we captured a 100-ton ship with ammunition. And then all of a sudden, as we also find out from prisoners, they're crossing the 17th parallel right straight down. There's absolutely no control over the 17th parallel. The Vietnamese troops are quite incapable of keeping it controlled right now. Then the next assumption is that North Vietnamese supplies can be interdicted even in Laos. If you look back at the Korean War, and I've just right now reread the U.S. Air Force history of the Korean War, North Korea is one-third smaller than North Vietnam, and the United States Air Force in Operation Strangle for a whole year interdicted every piece of road and track in North Korea. And the fact is, the North Korean and Chinese coolies still kept coming with the ammunition. In other words, it is simply not in the cards that a guerrilla trail can be interdicted by air power, unless you simply nuclearize the whole air stretch and just make a nuclear battlefield out of it. So I'm sure the president right now is weighing the political consequences of bombing theoretically neutralized Laos and factually neutralized Cambodia against the bonus that we might get of temporarily interdicting a few communist guerrilla trails.
Well, how about the cry that's been put up on the part of some people here, at least, Dr. Fall, that we should bomb the dock facilities and port area of Haiphong? Do you think this would have a major impact?
Mrs. Galley, when the French fought the Indochina War in Vietnam, they, the French, owned Haiphong and Hanoi. The French, in fact, owned every city in Indochina, every city over 5,000 people. The communists carried 4,500 tons of supplies a month to the battlefield of Dien Bien Phu over jungle trails. They came directly from China through jungle trails, crossed all of North Vietnam to the Laotian border where Dien Bien Phu is, and the French bombed all those supply roads. In other words, you could very well feed a major force in South Vietnam without ever using Haiphong and Hanoi. This is exactly why the government, in my view, wisely, has for the time being found it militarily not useful to bomb Haiphong and Hanoi.
But you were one of the men that say you cannot compare the French Indochinese War with what's going on now, that there is a quantum jump in air power in firepower that the French did not have. You also say that it's impossible for us to lose this war. How do you square that with the statement you just made, that they can supply this?
You know, geography remains the same, whether you have Americans or Frenchmen fighting over it. And the fact is, if Haiphong was geographically useless, because that's what we're speaking of, in 1954, it's just as geographically useless in 1966. The point here, again, is the United States owned every port of North Korea or shelled every port of North Korea, etc. All the coastlines were under subject to American attack and by battle wagons, which still existed at the time. This, too, didn't change anything. Here, this is all I'm saying. In other words, the United States air power is incomparably mightier than the French ever were. The United States can deliver in a day what the French delivered in a month. But the fact is, the choice of targets is just as bad now as was then. And this has to be remembered.
Well, Dr. Fall, do you think the Air Force attacks against North Vietnam then have been a failure?
Compared to what they had been advertised as being likely to achieve, they have, in fact, failed.
And what do you see as the outcome of all of this? How will it all end?
Well, as has been said at the beginning, a bloody stalemate, and let's hope that they get tired first.
But do you think that South Vietnam will survive as an independent nation?
I frankly don't know. As this year of 1965 ends, I simply don't know.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fall.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Dr. Bernard B. Fall, professor of international relations at Howard University in Washington, D.C., an expert on Vietnam. He was interviewed by ABC News correspondents Bill Downs and John Scalley. Next week at the same time, the American Broadcasting Company will bring you another program, From the Capitol. We hope you'll be with us. From the Capitol is produced by Peggy Whedon, a presentation of ABC News.